right after the international news.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Kelketh. We are not afraid of anyone. That was what Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said to his country early Tuesday in an address to the nation. The Ukrainian leader accused Russia of wrecking peace talks and ruled out making any territorial concessions. Zelensky said that Ukraine was committed to peace and diplomacy after Russia formally recognized two Russian-backed separatist regions as independent on Monday evening. The president said Ukraine was expecting clear and effective steps from its allies to act against Russia and called for an emergency summit of the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the deployment of troops to two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine after recognizing them as independent on Monday. AP diplomatic correspondent Matthew Lee reports the decree came after delivering a fact-bending discourse on European history.
Basically, a recitation of grievances that he and other Russians have had for a long time, and he did it in an extended format before finally cutting to the chase of what he was announcing at the very end, which is that Russia will recognize the independence of these two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk.
That was AP's Matthew Lee. A Reuters witness saw unusually large columns of military moving through the breakaway city of Donetsk after President Putin told Russia's defense ministry to send forces into the two regions to keep the peace. More on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. The UN political chief has opened an emergency meeting of the Security Council, the chief calling Russia's recognition of separatist areas in Ukraine's east a violation of the country's territorial integrity and sovereignty. Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo said that the risk of major conflict is real and needs to be prevented at all costs. DiCarlo told Monday's rare nighttime meeting that everyone involved should focus on ending hostilities immediately. She said the United Nations regretted Russia's order to deploy Russian troops into eastern Ukraine and expressed deep concern at reports of civilian casualties, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, and escalating shelling between government-controlled areas and the Russian-backed separatists. U.S. President Joe Biden responded by signing an executive order for a halt to all U.S. economic activity in the breakaway regions of Ukraine. The executive order also means a ban on import of all goods from those areas, as well as an investment there. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said the measures being rolled out in response to Putin's decree were separate from sanctions the U.S. and its allies have been readying if Russia invades Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the executive order is designed to prevent Russia from profiting off his blatant violation of international law. Washington was immediately joined by the European Union in announcing sanctions, with EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and Council President Charles Michel calling Putin's recognition of these separatist areas a blatant violation of international law as well. Japan will likely join U.S.-led sanctions on Russia, including a ban on chip and other key technology exports. That's according to Yomiuri newspaper on Tuesday, saying Japan's actions depend on if President Putin orders an invasion of Ukraine. Burkina Faso's national broadcaster says at least 59 people are dead after an explosion at a gold mining site in the southwest. RTB reported Monday that at least 100 other people were injured in Monday's blast in the village of Gomblora. The explosion was believed to have been caused by chemicals used to treat gold that were stocked at the site. Canadian lawmakers have voted to extend the powers that police can invoke to quell any potential restart of blockades by those opposed to COVID-19 restrictions. Lawmakers in the House of Commons voted 185 to 151 to affirm the powers Monday night. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said earlier that the powers were still needed despite police ending the occupation of the nation's capital.
Today is Tuesday, February 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden slams fresh sanctions on Russia as Moscow orders its forces into separatist regions in eastern Ukraine.
So right now, we don't know exactly what the scope of these punishments, these sanctions are going to be, but we've been told by the White House they're going to be serious and severe.
Australia reopens its borders to double vaccinated international tourists.
9 million foreign visitors used to head to Australia each year. But now the tourism industry is hoping that 2 years of disruption are coming to an end.
And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announces the scrapping of the land's domestic coronavirus restrictions in England. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The White House says President Joe Biden is ordering new sanctions on Moscow after Russia moved to recognize separatist eastern Ukraine regions. The Biden administration calls Monday's announcement by Russian President Vladimir Putin a, quote, blatant violation of Russia's international commitments, unquote. The sanctions will prohibit new investments, trade and financing in the two separatist regions of Ukraine recognized by Putin. The European Union's top officials have also said the bloc will impose sanctions. Ratcheting up the tension, President Putin ordered Russian forces to, quote, maintain peace, unquote, in separatist regions of eastern Ukraine. The announcement has raised fears that an invasion may be imminent. For more, I spoke with VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell.
The mood is quite tense. There's a lot of wait and see. We spent a lot of our morning waiting for Russian President Vladimir Putin to make his announcement, which, as we expected, was that he is going to recognize the two breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, which obviously is what spurred the White House to make this announcement that they're going to impose sanctions. So the White House has been a bit tense, a bit grim, and a bit quiet in terms of what they've been willing to show and reveal to journalists about their hand. Earlier, an eagle-eyed journalist spotted General Mark Milley, Defense Secretary Austin, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the White House. And it took quite a little bit of time for the White House to come back and say, yes, there's an important meeting. The president is consulting. So right now, it's a very cautious White House. It is probably a very concerned White House, and that's reflected in the gravity of their reaction to President Putin's announcement.
Is there a feeling in the White House that maybe President Putin is done after making this announcement, or are they still anticipating an invasion of Ukraine?
I think it's pretty clear that the White House is anticipating another act from Putin. When she made her long-awaited statement, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki did say, we are continuing to closely consult, and we're talking to partners and allies, including Ukraine, on the next steps and on Russia's ongoing escalation along the border with Ukraine. So I think it's clear that the White House does not expect President Putin to necessarily stop with just this, and that they're signaling that they're very ready to respond if he goes further.
The president announced as a reaction, fresh round of sanctions against Russia. What are these sanctions and how would that affect Moscow?
At this point in time, we don't have the details on what these financial instruments are going to be. All they said was that this executive order will prohibit new investment, trade, and financing by U.S. persons to, from, or in the so-called Donetsk and the Luhansk regions of Ukraine. So right now, we don't know exactly what the scope of these punishments, these sanctions are going to be, but we've been told by the White House they're going to be serious and severe.
That's VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with me from Washington. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric says the United Nations Secretary General is concerned about reports of increased ceasefire violations in Ukraine and urged the use of diplomacy amid fears of a Russian invasion. His remarks come as President Vladimir Putin railed against Ukraine in a televised address on Monday, saying that neo-Nazis were on the rise, oligarchic clans were rife, and that the ex-Soviet country was a U.S. colony with a puppet regime. Earlier in the day, Putin told leaders of France and Germany during phone calls on Monday that he planned to sign a decree recognizing the two breakaway regions of Ukraine as independent entities. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
The spokesperson of the UN did reiterate the UN's position, which is that the United Nations supports the independence, the sovereignty, the territorial integrity of Ukraine within its internationally recognized borders, which he added are stated very clearly in relevant UN General Assembly resolutions. And they called for restraint and not for any unilateral decisions or actions that could undermine the territorial integrity of Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is a sovereign country. And I think what we're hearing everywhere today in the West is you can't just decide to take a chunk out of a sovereign country and decide it belongs to you. There is what's called an international rules-based order. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres was just in Munich for the security conference that took place there. He spoke at that on Friday. And he was headed to the Democratic Republic of Congo for several days for another conference. But his spokesperson just announced a short while ago that he would be returning to New York immediately due to the situation in Ukraine, because it's just getting entirely too tense, too hot, and he needs to be in New York, I suppose, working the telephones. Also, the Ukrainians have asked for a meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss the situation. Now, they asked for that earlier Monday before Putin announced that he was recognizing these breakaway republics as part of Russia.
Aside from the United Nations officially reacting to what is going on, has any other country from the West, from Africa, anywhere else, have they reacted to this latest development?
Reactions are starting to roll in. But as I mentioned, the European Union president and the European Union foreign policy chief have said unequivocally it's a blatant violation of international law, and also saw that Boris Johnson of Britain has also condemned it as a violation of international law. But I imagine you're going to hear many countries condemning it. I noticed Albania, which is a member of the Security Council, their permanent mission on their Twitter feed also condemned it. So I'm sure we'll hear from each of the European Union bloc countries and other countries. Look, China is not excited about this, even though they're Russia's best friend.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Beshear speaking with me from New York. While the ongoing situation in Ukraine is the world focus, Russia has been rebuilding ties with Africa more quietly, strengthening economic and military cooperation on the continent. That is raising Western concerns about its tactics and goal there, as VOA's Carol Gernsberg reports.
Russian flags waved in Burkina Faso's capital following January's military coup in the West African nation. A statue unveiled in the Central African Republic last fall shows local soldiers backed by Russian fighters protecting civilians. Those are the more obvious symbols of Russia's resurgent presence on the continent. In 2019, at the first Russian-Africa summit of political and business leaders, Russian President Vladimir Putin made it clear Africa is a Russian priority.
It was agreed at the summit to create a new mechanism for dialogue in the form of a Russia-Africa partnership.
A second summit is planned for St. Petersburg in October. The first, in Sochi, generated diplomatic agreements and billions of dollars worth of deals for arms, agriculture, energy, and more, said organizer Roscongress Foundation. Moscow's overtures in recent years offer cooperation without what Putin has called the political or other considerations imposed by Western countries. The spread of militant Islamist extremism and other violence in Africa has created more openings for Russia's military. In Mali, so has the planned drawdown of troops by France, Mali's former colonial ruler and partner in the fight against jihadists for nearly a decade. Private military contractors also are helping advance Moscow's agendas in Africa, Western observers say. These include fighters in the shadowy Wagner Group, allegedly controlled by Putin associate Yevgeny Prigozhin. Putin has denied any connection with the group.
It is not the state. It is private business with private interests tied to extracting energy resources, including various resources like gold or precious stones.
But experts say whatever the goal, the result is that where the Wagner Group shows up, trouble follows. Joseph Siegel, with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says mercenaries are part of Moscow's toolkit to prop up weak African leaders in exchange for economic or other advantages. They aid elites, not average citizens.
Russia has been doing, deploying mercenaries, disinformation, election interference, arms for resources, deals, opaque contracts.
The United Nations is investigating reports of grave human rights abuses in the Central African Republic, allegedly committed by private military personnel. In Mali, the leaders of a 2020 military coup have brought in Russian military trainers and what U.S. and French authorities say are Wagner mercenaries. Some in Mali welcomed them by waving Russian flags, reflecting not only the country's historic ties with the former USSR, but also public impatience over continued insecurity. Niagale Bagayoko, who chairs the African Security Sector Network, says African countries are showing a willingness to look beyond a single foreign partner.
There is the realization of the fact that being only engaged with single actors or with a single group of countries is restricting the possibilities for diplomacy, but also for military apparatus.
Russia isn't the only foreign government trying to broaden influence in Africa, home to vast resources and a surging young population. The White House plans a second U.S.-Africa summit later this year, and the European Union has announced a new $170 million investment in infrastructure to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. China has been Africa's biggest economic partner for at least a decade. Carol Gunsberg, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced that he's scrapping the last domestic coronavirus restrictions in England, including the requirements for people with COVID-19 to self-isolate. Johnson says the country is, quote, moving from government restrictions to personal responsibility, unquote, as part of a plan for treating COVID-19 like other transmissible illnesses such as the flu. Johnson has confirmed that mandatory self-isolation for infected people will end Thursday. Johnson says it marks an end to, quote, two of the darkest, grimmest years in our peacetime history, unquote. Scientists, however, said ending support for people to test and isolate will hit poor people the hardest. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The inspiration for Africa's, quote, Great Green Wall Project, unquote, to plant trees across the continent to hold back the Sahara Desert came partly from Burkina Faso. While the project faces challenges and criticism, it still has champions who are teaching the next generation the importance of planting trees. Henry Wilkins reports from Burkina Faso.
In the arid savanna of Burkina Faso's countryside, for decades, local people have understood the importance of planting trees to protect their livelihoods and hold back the encroaching desert. Few more so than El Hadji Salafu Wadrago, who has run a business planting and nurturing the famous baobab trees for more than 40 years. He says at first he started producing mango trees, but quickly realized lots of people were already doing that. So having a baobab at home and having noticed that people came to the house all the time to ask for the baobab leaves for food, he thought to himself, why not produce it in large numbers, deciding it would be a big help to people. The baobab tree's fruit, leaves and bark are used by some Burkinabe people as an important food source and for medicinal purposes. Thomas Sankara, the country's president from 1983 to 1987 and a national hero for many in Burkina Faso, envisioned planting the baobab and all kinds of trees across the continent. He once said, step by step, tree by tree, we will create this great park of 10 million trees. Some say Sankara was the inspiration for the UN and World Bank-funded Great Green Wall, a projected 8,000-kilometre-long band of trees stretching from the southern edge of the Sahara Desert. Backers say the project will help fight the effects of climate change, drought, famine, conflict and migration. But critics like Giorgio Vasciano, an associate professor at the University of Milan, say after 15 years, the project is only 4% complete, with just 10 years left before its completion deadline.
I can see three different kinds of problems. One from the social point of view, obviously from the implementation point of view, and then the ecological consequences and feasibility. Territory that is going to be planted with trees is currently a conflict area, either with traditional military conflicts or with terrorism.
Backers of the project, like Remy Hemerick of SOS Sahel, say it is making gains and uniting communities.
So we have been working on the ground, mostly with rural communities, rehabilitating land and forest, also empowering local communities to get involved into the economic system. So we really believe that the Great Green Wall is one of the solutions for the Sahel region.
Rodrigo's son, who is taking on the family business, believes tree planting is essential for the future too.
Donc je l'accompagne sur tous les terrains qui est possible.
He says he accompanies his father everywhere, who shows him how to take care of the trees, and particularly the baobabs, which are a symbol of Africa, he adds. He also said it's important to save nature because, in his words, saving nature is saving the life of man. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Southwest Burkina Faso.
Australia has reopened its borders to double vaccinated international tourists. They have been shut out since March 2020 under some of the world's toughest COVID-19 measures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
9 million foreign visitors used to head to Australia each year. But now the tourism industry is hoping that 2 years of disruption are coming to an end. More than 50 international flights were scheduled to land in Australia on Monday as its borders reopened. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the country was going from COVID cautious to COVID confident when it comes to travel. While many tourism businesses share his enthusiasm, some believe the recovery will be slow and that it will take time for overseas visitors to return in large numbers. Margie Osmond, the chief executive of the Tourism and Transport Forum, an industry body, says as Australia tries to attract overseas visitors, it will face competition from other countries.
Rebuilding confidence is critical, whether it's here domestically or whether it's about global travel. We are going to have to do considerable work to make people feel comfortable about coming here again. But what complicates it even more, massively competitive global marketplace now. Everybody wants that leisure tourist back.
Australia's largest markets for inbound tourism were China and New Zealand, two countries that still have strict COVID-19 travel controls. Tourism Australia, the country's official marketing agency, has said it has plans to attract visitors from Britain, Europe, the United States, Japan and Korea. Prime Minister Morrison said international travellers who came to Australia would have one of the greatest experiences they could ever imagine. Under current rules, foreign visitors must have received 2 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. Australia has recorded about 2.7 million coronavirus infections and 4,900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
Rising sea levels are threatening Indonesia's capital, Jakarta. To relieve pressure on the area, the government is planning to move the national seat of power. But the plan is facing skepticism and resistance. As VOA's Eunice Salim reports in this story, narrated by Nova Povadi.
Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, is a city of over 10 million people, with millions more in the suburbs. It has been the seat of power in the Indonesian archipelago for centuries. But climate change is taking its toll, as President Joe Biden noted in a speech to U.S. national intelligence officials in July last year.
What happens in Indonesia, if the projections are correct, that in the next 10 years they may have to move their capital because they're going to be underwater?
By 2024, the administration of Indonesian President Joko Widodo wants to lay the groundwork for moving the nation's capital to a new city, to be named Nusantara in East Kalimantan province on the island of Borneo. Jakarta is congested, overpopulated, and by some estimates, a third of it will have sunk by 2050. Indonesia is not the first country to move its capital in recent years. Egypt is looking to do so around 2024 too, to an administrative city just outside its current capital, Cairo. Myanmar moved its capital from Yangon, also known as Rangoon, to Naypyidaw. Even South Korea devolved some administrative functions from Seoul to Sejong, but experts say it won't be an easy move. Feely, an Australian expert on Indonesia, notes that previous attempts to move a capital have involved the same landmass. Indonesia's plan to move the seat of power to a whole different island will be a much larger ordeal.
It will be very interesting to see. It would be a great triumph for Indonesia if they can build it in budget and on time. But is anyone confident that that would happen?
Other analysts are equally skeptical of the administration's goal to complete the first phase by 2024, including building a new smart state palace and key ministries in Nusantara. Polls show that Indonesians themselves remain divided on the move, with residents of Jakarta overwhelmingly opposed to the plan. For Yuni Salim, Nova Purwadi, VOA News.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, presents the latest sea level rise projections for all U.S. states and territories by decade for the next 100 years and beyond. The report, called the Sea Level Rise Technical Report, projects that the sea level along the U.S. coastline will rise an extra 25.4 to 30.5 centimeters by 2050. NOAA, in a press release, says that rise in sea level is about equal to what was experienced in the previous 100 years. Along with projecting rising sea levels, the new report also contains information on tide, wind, and storm-driven extreme water levels that will affect current and future coastal flooding risks. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Navy veteran Mark Frerichs has been held captive for 2 years. Frerichs, a civil engineer and contractor from Lombard, Illinois, had long worked in Afghanistan on development projects for the benefit of the Afghan people. He was taken hostage on January 31, 2020, according to press reports. Frerichs is believed to be held by the Taliban. The State Department Rewards for Justice program is currently offering up to $5 million for information that leads to the location, recovery, and return of Frerichs. Threatening the safety of Americans or any innocent civilians is always unacceptable, and hostage taking is an act of particular cruelty and cowardice, said President Joe Biden in a White House statement. The Taliban must immediately release Mark before it can expect any consideration of its aspirations for legitimacy. This is not negotiable. State Department spokesperson Ned Price reiterated in a statement, "The United States has raised Mark's case in every meeting with the Taliban, and we have been clear that the legitimacy the Taliban seek is impossible to consider while they hold a U.S. citizen hostage." Frerichs' release is among our core non-negotiable priorities, stated spokesperson Price. We will continue to send a clear message to Taliban leadership. Immediately and safely release Mark and disavow the practice of hostage taking. President Biden addressed Mark Frerichs and other Americans being held hostage or wrongfully detained overseas and their families and friends who are enduring the nightmare of their absence. "Know that my administration will continue to work steadfastly until every American being unjustly held against their will comes home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the voice of America. Washington, bah, bah, bah.